I don't think we fight enough today. You know, it tells you where you stand. It tells you where the other people stand. In our day and age of wanting to say niceties and political correctness, it's refreshing to be honest. And this is a great chapter about that. Thank you, Dale. I love the series we've been doing, Gospel of John. I hope you're appreciating it as well. It's one of my favorite Gospels. A little background on John, just as a reminder. John is writing towards the end of his life. He's a bit older. He's seen a lot happen. He saw this little movement, a little Jewish group, grow from a handful to thousands, then back again to two or three at the cross, and then wonderfully, miraculously, to a multinational movement of not only Jews, but Greeks and Persians and barbarians and Romans and all kinds of people became this international movement called the church. And also he saw some cataclysmic events in his own time. His brother was killed for his faith. He saw many of his friends persecuted. He himself was sent into exile. He saw the temple destroyed. Now, the temple for Judaism was a huge thing. As you can tell from this chapter, the temple really is central to Jewish life. It was the center of cultural life as well. So when the temple's destroyed, this is a cataclysmic event for the Jewish people, kind of like a 9/11, but having been there, or a Bataclan event. And so John is writing on the other side of all these things. And Gospels have already been written. So we might ask, why is John writing this fourth Gospel way later than the others that were earlier? Well, he speaks to that because probably some people were wondering, asking themselves the same question. He said, now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. So he's saying, you know, I know those guys who wrote the other Gospels, and they're good guys. They're good accounts. We've been through hell and high water together, and it's right what they wrote. But it's impossible to say everything that Jesus said or did. And some things that he has said has helped me through these tough times. And if you pay attention to them, you will have life, true life. Fullness of life. So in our days of coronavirus and strikes and instability, I think that the Gospel of John is a particularly pertinent and relevant chapter, and that's what keeps on coming through in John. It's not just life, but fullness of life. It's not just bread, like we saw last week, but true bread. It's not just water, it's living water. So Jesus is fulfilling the promises of the prophets before him. John sees him as that fulfillment. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Why do you spend money for what is not bread and your wages for what does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me and eat what is good and delight yourself in abundance. So the message of John, for those who are in abundance, you think life is good? Well, baby, you ain't seen nothing yet. And for those who are not yet in abundance, you have equal access to these torrents of living water. So let's jump into the chapter, huh, with that small introduction. There's a feast and there's a fight, and some of the best parties and some of the best fights. You all have one question in mind. Who was there, right? Well, here we have Jesus and his brothers, and it begins with a family spat. Family spats are never good. And John is quite honest about the differences between him and his brothers. His brothers did not believe in him. Actually, I think I have a PowerPoint, if you guys could get that on there. So, you know, the older brother, for those of you who know Middle Eastern culture or Asian culture, the older brother should not be leaving home. The older brother should be taking care of his family. The older brother should be helping with the family needs. And what is Jesus doing? He's leading others into some sort of spiritual journey. So these brothers, they're not constructively criticizing him. They're goading him on and challenging him in the most petty way. Not to see him succeed, but in order to see him fail. You know, ça l'apprendra. You know, that way he'll come to his senses in a sense. And of course, who else is there? There's also his friends and extended family. And, of course, there are the Jews. who are seeking to kill him. And I find that a bit unfortunate translation, because everyone in this passage, everyone in this chapter, bar none, are Jewish. The writer's Jewish. Jesus is Jewish. His brothers are Jewish. The crowds that believe in him are Jewish. But for some reason, the translator saw fit to say the Jews are trying to kill him. Well, let me just say, only part of the Jews were trying to kill him. And I find that a bit unfortunate, because anti-Semitism is a reality today, and it's a reality for the Jewish people in France. There's a recent episode. I'll open a parenthesis here to give a little plug on how the Jewish people are doing. Recent episode with a retired doctor in the 11th arrondissement of Paris called Dr. Sarah Halimi. She was tortured and then thrown off her balcony in the 11th arrondissement of Paris, and her murderer was caught. And just last December was released because the judges ruled that because he was smoking marijuana, he was not responsible for his actions. Of course, this is outrageous, because the same person who smokes marijuana and runs someone over in the car is culpable for smoking marijuana and for killing someone. So the anti-Semitic climate in France for the Jewish people is rather rough and causing Jewish people to leave in masses. It's home. France, which is home to the largest Jewish population in Europe, is becoming home to the largest mass immigration of Jews from France. When Jews leave a country because of persecution, it's never a good thing for that country. And so my prayer is that you would pray and support the Jewish people, and to the translators, try and be a little bit more careful with your words, because words do matter. So I'll close that parenthesis. Ah, there we go. That's the feast of, now, in Jewish law, there were three feasts where we're supposed to come to Jerusalem. And these three feasts are Passover, Shavuot, Pentecost, and Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. So here I have a picture of Jewish people gathering at Jerusalem at the Wailing Wall for the feast. Flavius, so it's a law that you're supposed to be there, but it's such a great party that everybody wanted to be there. Flavius Josephus says that there were over 3 million people at Jerusalem during the time of the feast. And Flavius Josephus counted men only. So that didn't include women and children, and so it was really a great party. And this party lasted about 8 days. And we can go to the next slide. And at this party, we would build tabernacles. And in these tabernacles, we would sit and rejoice and remember that God brought us through the wilderness wandering. So it was a time of R&R. It was a time of remembering, and it was a time of rejoicing. And so, of course, because the Feast of Tabernacles is a commemoration of the harvest, I think we can go to the next slide. The harvest was the promise that God promised to the people of Israel. Now, water is a real issue all over the world. We talk about glaciers becoming smaller, but nowhere is water more so an issue than in the Middle East, and especially at Jesus' times, where they didn't have the types of technology that we have today. They depended greatly on rain, and God promised that if the people were faithful, he would send the rain in the latter season. Well, Sukkot, or Tabernacles, is the end of the season. The bountiful harvest is coming in, and so people are praying for rain on a daily basis. Literally, rain was their salvation. We can go to the next slide. During the Feast of Tabernacles, we would wave palm branches and fruits that reminded us of God's promise, reminded us of the wilderness wanderings. And so wine flowed, people drank, people danced all night. There were huge candelabrum that would light every single courtyard, every single nook and cranny of Jerusalem. We can go on to the next slide. And people would just dance all night for 8 days, celebrating in God's goodness, in God's abundance. During this time, Jesus also said, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in darkness, but have the light of life." There was one other ceremony, which is important for us to understand in order to really get this chapter. It's the ceremony of water drawing. And it was the last day of the feast, the last day that we read about in this chapter. There was a symbolic water drawing ceremony. What the people would do, all of the people would gather together in Jerusalem. And then a priest, or someone who dealt with sacrifices, a Levite, would leave the temple. And then we could go to the next slide and come back to this one later. Yeah, thanks. The priest, or the Levite, would leave the temple. He would be carrying a golden pitcher full of water, representing the prayer for rain. He would actually go to the the pool, the Siloam pool, for those of you who know the Siloam pool in the New Testament, he would fill it with water and come back to the temple. And as he came back to the temple with his pitcher full of water representing the prayers for rain, a crowd of people would surround him and start singing and dancing behind him. There was a sort of a cacophonous event that they would come to the altar and then another priest would join him with a bowl full of wine representing the harvest. And then they would go around the altar seven times. And seven times they'd go on the altar, and at the last seventh time they were reciting the Psalms. They came to the Psalm that said, Ana Adonai Hoshiana, Lord, save now. Ana Adonai Hatzlichana, Lord, send your blessing, send your prosperity to us now. And then they would empty the contents of the wine and the water on the altar, and then people would start screaming and dancing, and it was so cacophonous, so loud. People would take their palm branches and throw them on the ground, and the fruit would be squashed on the ground, and the air was filled with fragrance. And it was like the best party of the year. And the Talmud says, if you haven't seen this celebration, you don't know what real joy is. So let's go to the next slide. The slide before that we skipped. So that's Jesus in this crowd. And you notice something about the language in the verse. It says that Jesus has to kind of stand up, brace himself, and yell, because he's in the midst of this feast. And what does he say? He says, I'm it. I'm the answer to your prayers. If anyone thirsts, let him come unto me, and out of your belly, out of your heart, out of your inward man will flow rivers of living water. Well, that is so intense that some people say, it's him. He's the Messiah. It's so intense that others say, he can't be the Messiah. What he's saying is blasphemous. Well, as you know, they say, two Jews, three opinions, and it's no truer than in this passage. You know, so then people start talking about, you know, what does that mean? Or maybe what they really are saying, when the real bar fight begins here, the real brawl, he says, who is this guy? Or maybe the better question is, who does he think he is? You know, people couldn't swallow Jesus. He was saying things that bother them, as we saw last week and as we see in this chapter. See, the real Jesus can't be managed. He's not docile. He's not tame. He's wild and dangerous. Dangerous to the status quo, dangerous to the way we want to lead our lives. He says what we don't want to be said. No, you don't have one husband, you've had five. Like he said to the Samaritan woman, or to a rabbi at dusk, no, you must be born again. But in the text, there is a subtext. There's a question behind the questions. And that question is, who do you think Jesus is? Is he a good man? You look at what Jesus says and you look at his life and you say, you know what, that's a good guy, a teacher, a great humanitarian, a profoundly good person. Well, you're absolutely right. Jesus was a good man. But the text is also telling us that he was much, much more than that, that he is the source of all life. Or maybe you're coming from the inside perspective, kind of like his family, who just don't believe. They're just prodding and picking and saying, prove yourself, show yourself, go to Jerusalem. Convince me, convince us. Okay, I get it, you're a bit more reasonable, and it's perfectly natural and reasonable to want proof, and there is proof out there. There's proof in history, there's proof in documentation. You deserve proof. There's plenty of proof. Jesus doesn't need to prove himself, but he wants to prove himself, just as he did with his brothers. He goes to Jerusalem to show himself to the world, but he wants to prove himself to you personally. I think you can turn that off now. A little glimpse of the end of what happened to his brothers. What's interesting is that they go from this place of non-belief to the place of great belief later on, many years after Jesus' death. It's said that Jesus, when he rose from the dead, was shown to different people after his resurrection. And it makes note that he showed himself particularly to his brothers in one-on-one with one brother among the others. And those brothers, James, wrote an epistle in the New Testament. He became a leader of the church. Another one of his brothers, Jude, also wrote a book that's in the New Testament. His uncle, Simon, became also a leader in the church. For some reason, something happened in the lives of his brothers that they went from disbelief to belief after they met the resurrected Jesus personally. And they died martyr's death, defending that belief, defending their brother, defending that they had seen the risen Christ. Or maybe you're here this morning and you're saying, well, he should be, that's enough. That man must be stopped. Arrest him. For those who know a bit about French culture, if you remember what the minister said to Patrick Elkabbach, taisez-vous Elkabbach. It's enough. Religion has had its time. It's an unnecessary crutch in the age of science and reason. Well, what Jesus says is not acceptable. He cannot be God and man in one. A person who leads other people astray, like other cult leaders, should not be allowed to speak. You know what? I've got to tell you, you're also right. Well, how can they be all right? Well, you're right too. If you're in that category, you're probably among the most honest among us. No one should be allowed to mislead and hurt people, unless what Jesus is saying is true, unless he truly is God come in the flesh, unless he truly is the way, the truth, and the life. I have a friend called Joël Gounoun, who is a professor in physics and a black belt in several martial arts and a profound Buddhist, and he said that at one exercise before they started sparring, they spent some time in meditation, and he started paying homage to different masters, Gandhi, Buddha, and a whole list of spiritual masters. And at the end, there was a picture of Jesus. And for some reason, he couldn't get himself to bow to Jesus. Something bothered him about Jesus. And it bothered him that he was bothered about it because he considered himself an open guy. And then I think what Joel came to realize later is that Jesus bothered him because Jesus was standing for the truth and telling him a truth about Joel himself that Joel didn't want to hear, that you're a sinner. And you need saving. And that is what Jesus is telling the people in this chapter. That is what Jesus is trying to tell us all this morning. There's another question that we ask about fights, especially when someone calls the police. Who started it? Well, Jesus started it. Jesus threw the first punch in many ways. Especially in the way that he reminds the Jewish people of their wilderness wanderings. Remember that Sukkot or Tabernacles is R&R, remember and rejoice. Well, Jesus, in this little quote that he's telling the Jewish people, is reminding them of a scene in the wilderness where we were sick and tired of being sick and tired. 40 years of wilderness wandering, no food, no water, just this miserable manna. We missed the garlic, we missed the onions, and more than anything, we were just tired of doing camping. Camping's great for 8 days, but camping's not so great after 40 years. And so they said, Moses, we're just going to die out here. There's no water. We're going to die. We're instead of having a good cemetery, a proper burial in Egypt, we're going to die as carrion to the birds of the air in the wilderness with our kids beside us. So they said, since we're all going to die, Moses, you're going to be the first one to go. So God says to Moses, go ahead and listen to the people. So they took Moses outside of the camp, and outside of the camp is the place of banishment. It's the place of execution. And Moses stands in front of the witnesses, in front of the elders of Israel, and they take the rod of Aaron. And then God says to Moses, step aside. The rod comes down. It doesn't strike Moses. It strikes a rock. And out of the rock come flowing rivers of living water. The best water they've had in all of their lives. And this is what Jesus is saying to the Jewish people at this feast of remembering and rejoicing. This is what Jesus is saying to all of us and to all people of all times. He is picking a fight, and he's saying, your hearts are made of stone. Your choices are self-ruinous and selfish, but I have the solution. I am the solution. It's not easy, but I will throw a punch as I have, and it will come around and hit me in my own face. I will stand in your place. I will take the blow that you deserve. As Isaiah said, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. It is a promise, not just of salvation, but of life, real life, abundant life. As a result, not only will you be satisfied, but you will become a source of life in the stony places. It is the water that he offered to the Samaritan woman, after which you will never thirst again. It is the new beginning he promised Nicodemus to be born again. It is the bread of life that fed the 5,000. It is the he must increase and I must decrease of John the Baptist. It is not just a one-time thing. It is the promise that if you give it all to him, he will give it all to you. Now, John says that he said this about the Spirit whom those who believed in him were to receive, for as yet the Spirit had not been given because Jesus was not yet glorified. Something happened at the cross that was wonderful for all to see, except for those who are going through it. It was a terrible time of suffering for Jesus, for his mother, for his friends, to see their friend, their rabbi, their master, their son, tortured in that way. And yet when Jesus rose from the dead, he had a glorified body. He could cross walls. He could be 40 kilometers away in the space of a few minutes. And even though he had that glorified body, he maintained the scars on his hands and his feet. The reminder of that terrible suffering, because that suffering, which at that point seemed so meaningless and cruel and tragic and horrible, at the resurrection was glorified. At the resurrection became a source of joy and strength and everlasting life. And this is the promise that the Spirit gives us, that through the cross there is a new paradigm, that every stony place in our lives can become a source of life. As each time death crosses our door, whether it's through the coronavirus or financial ruin, there's not only deliverance in those times of hardship, but there's life. There's not only suffering and sorrow, but another experience of suffering and sorrow. The inevitable tragedies of life, you can say, the more you slay me, the more you'll raise me. And your experience will that become be one of Joseph. Joseph, who was sold to slavery, in prison, and yet God used all that to make him the savior of the world. And Joseph told his brothers, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. And that is what every single experience of this life can be. But you have to experience it for yourself. You have to let Jesus pick that fight with you, and then you'll be able to enjoy the party with him. You know, the Talmud says, he who has not experienced the Feast of Tabernacles has never seen real joy. And just so, the salvation experience can't be a vicarious one. You have to experience it for yourself. If you think you've got a good life, well, baby, you ain't seen nothing yet. A one-on-one experience of the risen Jesus. You know, it's interesting that when Jesus did appear to his brothers, there's no record of what transpired. There's no record of what was said. Discretion was of the utmost. I'm sure it was deep, and as their lives showed, life transforming. If you need proof, he'll give you proof. If you need reason, he will give you reasons. If you want to know if he really is who he says he is, then he will reveal himself to you. But you have to take the first step. Give him your pain and he will dry your tears. Give him your heart. Give him your thirst and you will never thirst again. Amen.